On behalf of the students and the faculty of the College of Arts and Letters, it is my privilege to welcome you to this arts festival. There is probably no state in the Union that is more continuously conscious of the meeting of cultures than the state of Alaska. We meet them every day. And the committee of the festival has chosen the conflict of cultures as its special theme for the Arts Festival this year. I wish to invite your attention to the meeting that will be held here in this building next Sunday afternoon at 3:00, in which experts on the cultures of Alaska will be meeting for panel discussion. While the state may be the most continuously conscious of cultures, our culture interest is probably not that which is the most self-conscious cultural conflict or problem in our nation today. And this evening, it is our pleasure to address ourselves to that most self-conscious cultural conflict. The procedure will be two main speeches, followed by a few comments on each speaker by the other, after which I will provide an opportunity for those who wish to leave to excuse themselves at that time. Those who will remain will be invited to ask questions of the speakers and participate as part of a group as a whole. This evening, it is my pleasure to introduce a person who has been most instrumental in providing us with this fine program this evening, who will introduce our first speaker, Professor Edmund Skellings of the Department of English. Professor Skellings.
Might be said that a writer's sole concern should be with definition. For those of you who collect definitions of obscenity, as I do, Ralph Ellison once added a very delightful extra to my catalog. At an Esquire symposium a few years ago, he looked at the steak before him and said, "This fillet is obscene." And I had unphrased and definitely unspoken visions of censored T-bones and under-the-counter New York cuts. But that evening, Mr. Ellison was to indulge in more definition, and this time a bit more serious. America, he said, was written into existence by writers. Now, in his new book, Shadow and Act, Ralph Ellison adds another definition which is particularly applicable here tonight. He writes, "And isn't one of the implicit functions of the American frontier to encourage the individual to a kind of dreamy wakefulness, a state in which he makes, in all ignorance of the accepted limitations of the possible, rash efforts, quixotic gestures, hopeful testings of the known and the given," unquote. The accepted limitations of the possible. How many limits of his possibility should an individual accept? The question is basic to our time. National Book Award winner Ralph Ellison has been a fellow of the American Academy in Rome, visiting professor at the University of Chicago, visiting professor at Rutgers University. During the past year, he delivered the Gertrude Clark Woodall Lecture at the Library of Congress and the Ewing Lectures at the University of California. He has just been appointed to the American Institute of Arts and Letters. It is my pleasure to present to you a man who has added so considerably not only to the redefinition of the American Negro, but to the delineation of that remarkable phenomenon of history, the American character, Mr. Ralph Ellison.
Being right here is perhaps the best definition of cultural conflict that you're going to get from me tonight. To have come so far to talk about a problem which is so mysterious, no matter how much we think about it, is, to say the least, arrogant. But I'm glad I came, and I was given a good caribou steak tonight, so that should give me certain courage. We speak of cultural conflict, and I can only think, I can't help but steal something from a Mr. Aikenson I met today, who told me, who gave me a prime example, although he was concerned with other things. But this, I think, is a prime example of cultural conflict. He tells me of an Alaskan who decided that he had had enough of the frontier, in quotes, and he had gone to Arkansas, whereupon he proceeded to indulge himself in practical jokes, and he painted his house red in a town wherein white was the norm. That is cultural conflict. One needn't go beyond that, I suppose. But quite seriously, and to feel my way into this, I would first remind you that whatever I have to say is limited by my particular way into cultural matters, and that is through the problem of trying to make stories out of the life that I've known. And the life that I've known starts on a body of land which became a state. In fact, it's the 46th state, which doesn't put me so far behind what's happening to you, I suppose. I must talk out of Oklahoma. This is where it started, and I must talk as one who was a beneficiary of and who suffered some of the disadvantages of parents who came from the Deep South, from Abbeville, South Carolina, to be more specific, and a little place called White Oak, Georgia. Now, these parents of mine, like most Americans, told me very little about themselves, and certainly very little about the parental background. This is quite understandable. I thought for a long time that this occurred simply because there were slaves on both sides of my parents' families. This wasn't that they were ashamed of this. It was simply a matter of being perhaps unconsciously in agreement with one of the first requirements, it seems, to be an American, and that is you must have a conflict with the past. You must have a conflict with what happened before, with those shaping events, and even sometimes with the language, if you come from far enough away. It's a matter of putting aside the past. I would call this a kind of built-in Rousseauism, wherein you decide that you're not going to burden the children with those shaping and limiting factors and that limiting and shaping knowledge which had given character to the parents. And my parents shared this. It was for a long, many years, sometimes, in some cases, instances, only recently that I learned the significance of some of the things that really influenced me, attitudes that my parents had, and not only racial attitudes, but matters of taste, attitudes toward the written history of the country, attitudes toward the myths which surrounded us, attitudes toward politics, and so on. These shaping influences were sort of kept in the background out of the assumption that the children would have a better chance if they just took what was at hand and went as far with this lack of burden, it was assumed, as they could go. And so it was with me. I knew that I came from a town, at least my parents came from a town, my father came from a town where the Confederacy started before it went to Montgomery. I knew also that my father had run away from home when he was young. And, of course, he had. I knew that this had something to do with my grandfather's strictness. I didn't have too much spelled out about the other conditions within the town. But there were cultural conflicts, there were, of course, political conflicts between my father and his father and my father's group and the majority group in that town. Well, what did this do? It led to a wandering on a part of a young man who joined the army when he was still in his teens and ended up fighting in the Spanish-American War, being in China, being in the Philippines, in fact, being all over the world. And it led also to a break with the particular folk ways that he had inherited in South Carolina, and ended up with him going to Oklahoma, working as a foreman for a construction company which built the first tall buildings. 12 stories made a tall building out there when I was a boy. This, of course, happened before I was born. But the complex of influences, the complex of knowledge, the cultural influences which had helped shape him and his ideals were much more complex than I had first imagined, because, like most Americans, I was taught to think in terms of the myths sponsored by sociology, I'm afraid, and to think of myself in terms of the very important political and social realities which take the shape of racism. I don't like that term, but it's a very useful one. So that it wasn't until I began to work trying to make stories out of my own experience that this whole problem of culture and cultural conflicts took on some kind of concrete meaning for me. And this is as it should be. It was inescapable. because I first came into writing through music. And the odd thing about a town like Oklahoma City, when I grew up, is that you had many, many people. You had, of course, many Indians. We were not integrated as you are. I never went to school with an outright Indian. I went to school with natives. And the natives were not the Indians in Oklahoma. They are not today the Indians. The natives are people of Negro blood who were either owned by some of the Indian tribes or who escaped from slavery in the Deep South and went to the Indian Territory. So when you hear Bessie Smith singing, "I'm going to the nation, going to the territory," she means that she's going to the nation, whether she knew it or not. And she was going to the Indian Territory because the slaves were escaping long before the Civil War and going out into the Southwest. And indeed, some got into California, and it is reliably reported that the City of the Angels was really founded by people of Negro blood who had gotten mixed up with Indians and the Spanish. Of course, this is the reality behind a lot of the myths, and that's how we managed to keep going with this thing. The various complexities began to come into focus for me when I began to think back upon what I actually did as a child as against what I am supposed to have done. And of course, as a little Negro boy, I got into music because I danced European folk dances very well. Now, no one told us that, you know, you little kids are dancing European folk dances. But this was something that our school had decided that American children should know how to do, and thus we did these dances. And you would go to the Western League baseball park in May, on May Day, and we wrapped the maypoles, and we danced the Irish and Scottish reels, and we did Polish dances, and so on. That was all a part of it. And with these dances went certain music. And it wasn't until several years later when they instituted the music appreciation courses that I realized, well, my God, I've been dancing to German music and to Scotch music. And in fact, I've been dancing to everything but American music. Of course, that was the way that went. Later, as I say, I began to play music. And this is one of the most revealing experiences, because you began to feel, well, yes, this piece of music is an aria from Verdi, but Louis Armstrong plays it. He plays this particular aria when he is playing the Potato Head Blues. How did this happen? But more important, isn't it wonderful that Louis Armstrong knew Verdi? And yet they say that he didn't go to school. And of course, you can see where I'm going, I suppose, is that out of in this country, let's put it this way, in this country, and I'm aware that I'm in the United States because I saw beer cans on the highway. In this country, everything was given in the basic sense. We are a continuum of Europe. We are the heirs and heiresses of all the ages. And we were were as a country like Adam and Eve, just thrown out of Eden, but with the advantage of having many of the things of the earth already named, defined for us. We're in the position of carrying culture with us, of being the bearers of culture without really being in awe of culture. In fact, we bent over backwards in the other direction. We were downright antagonistic toward European culture, and this is understandable. It was even necessary in order for us to break the hold of the past upon us, and thus upon our sense of possibility. It was necessary to pretend that these values had absolutely no value for us. And yet, when we read Parkman's The Oregon Trail and so on, he describes how he went west the Great Prairie and was so shocked to find out on the edge of the prairie in Oregon a snug little house such as you have here, which was full of vintage wines and the latest French novels. That's rather shocking and goes very much against the grain of the American myth of the new Adam, the man who comes into the world with no particular culture, only with nobility, and he makes of the world around him a new Eden, which somehow, due to the outsider, sometimes the outsider is called the Indian, sometimes he's called the Negro, the slave, sometimes he's called the German, sometimes he's called the Jew, and I suppose sometimes he's called the Eskimo. But for these outsiders, Eden would have been reconstituted and the world would have been created anew, and new culture would have made the city of God on earth. We have the same argument going on now in New York, around Greenwich Village, where there are Negro writers who say, we have to have our own criticism, we have to have our own ideals, we have to create out of our black intelligence. What I'm trying to describe is a very American sense of the newfound possibility, which always has a fly of some kind in the ointment. Well, the fact of it is that just as the country offered an opportunity for a redefinition, not a new constitution of culture, but a redefinition of culture, a reapplication of the best ideas, philosophical and especially political political philosophy, new ideas of justice and so on, to be put into operation during the establishment of the United States. Each movement toward the frontier has offered a new opportunity to redefine, to reestablish, and to make new syntheses of culture. Now, this leads inevitably to conflicts between the various diverse groups who make up the United States. It did in the beginning, and it does now, and I suppose it ever shall be. One even hopes that the conflict will continue, but it will continue on a conscious level. When you think back to the years when the New England culture dominated the intellectual life of the country, it was assumed that the image of the American experience would be that of New England. It was dominant, it was forceful, and it won the right to be so. But we also know that during the same period, American life was burgeoning, thriving, changing itself, undergoing many processes of metamorphosis in the South, and in indeed wherever there was a frontier. This was going on through the interaction between the original American ideals and the concrete conditions in which Americans try to make these ideals manifest. They grew by lending careful attention to the climate and to nature, let's put it that way, and by adapting received ideas, received techniques, most of all, received folklore to the existing conditions. Thus you had metamorphosis of English folklore and music and French and German and Spanish and so on, and the African tribal lore, all being transformed under the diverse conditions out of which the Americans, and I emphasize the plural, the Americans were evolving. Each was living as he felt he had to live, dominating as he could, protecting himself as he could, establishing his dominance as he could. But, and this is a wonderful thing about it, this circumstance was a ground for very often a very creative conflict of cultures. People were taking from one another. They were using what they could as provided by the various neighbors. Sometimes you learn to survive by adapting the techniques, even the art of the people whom you despised. Certainly, this is how we got a foothold on the continent, by learning to be almost as good in the woods as the Indians, and by adapting our technology, that is Western technology, to the conditions of the wilderness, and by learning how the Indians used some Western inventions. It was a process of slaughtering, stealing, taking, using, sometimes with admiration, sometimes with self-hate, and so on. But out of it, a nation came into being. Out of it, on the level of literature, a very rich body of folklore, or I should say bodies of folklore, began to evolve. Bodies of folklore which found their most articulate and artistic expression within the English language, and finding their base in New England. The American image in terms of formal literature began to take shape when we had lived in this country long enough to have absorbed the various attempts at defining the American experience and the American personality, the American character, which had been carried out by the various bodies of folklore. I am at this moment reviewing a book called The Negro Cowboy. Some of you might have seen this book reviewed in the national magazines. The book is a scholarly work, heavily documented, carried out by two English teachers from the University of California. And they have gone through all the documents, and lo and behold, they reveal that the American cowboy was also sometimes black, and sometimes Indian, and sometimes Mexican. This is a wonderful story, some details of which I knew coming from Oklahoma, where many of these people still live. The amazing thing about it, and I mention this because I want to talk about something else which is so important in the cultural conflict, and that is the sort of controlled forgetfulness with which Americans confront their experience. I have certain theories about why we find it so convenient to forget from generation to generation what has happened. But I won't burden you with that theory, but I will point out to you that through the dominance of certain minority groups, the American past and the cultural conflicts which have made for its richness and made for its character are submerged. They are repressed. And we substitute for the actual conditions, for the actual facts, popular culture. This is why the opponents of popular culture in this country are on the right track, but they seldom give the right answers, as far as I'm concerned. And the reason that popular culture has been so damaging in this country is not because it's simply been bad, but because it has been an instrumentality for suppressing the facts of our national existence. And this, I think, is best dramatized by the revelations made in this book, The Negro Cowboy. Because, you know, you never see Negro cowboys unless you watch some of the recent television westerns. For the most part, he's the only thing that black that gets in there is when the bad guy is wearing a black hat and black jeans, I suppose. But the actual history. And of course, here is where we have to come back to history. We know that the cattle industry was not made by Southerners, nor was it really made by Westerners. It was made by Southerners who became Westerners, and it started.